Have you ever been tired before?
Never.
Never been tired.
What's that like?
So the past few weeks, I've been tired. And not just because of my cluster headaches, which deplete my battery life, but for a lot of other reasons. And I wonder if you've been tired as well. It's a different type of tired. It's not like a physical exhaustion. It's a different type of tired. It's a tired captured most aptly in the words of Langston Hughes in his poem entitled Tired. Here's what he writes. He says, I'm so tired of waiting. Aren't you? For the world to become good and beautiful and kind. Let us take a knife and cut the world in two and see what worms are eating at the rind. Anybody else tired? Anyone else getting a little bit fatigued waiting on the world to become beautiful and good and kind? I mean, we don't have to do much to get tired these days, do we? You have to turn on the news. All you have to do is pick up your phone. All you have to do is scroll just a little bit. Sometimes all you have to do is walk into the other room, or you have to walk into the office door, and you're hit with a myriad of reasons why you are tired of waiting for the world to become good and beautiful and kind. And in some ways, I think it may be just a little bit more difficult as Christians. Now, I'm not making an equivalency that for false persecution. But of all the demographics in the world, we as Christ followers understand and believe that there is a mighty, benevolent, all-powerful God who is actively working through His Son, through His Word, through His church, and through His people to make the world good and beautiful and kind. And sometimes, just because we know that, it makes us a little bit more tired. Wondering, waiting, hoping. Is this what it's like to wait for Christ to return? And sometimes while we wait, we get tired. But what I love about Langston Hughes's poem is that he moves from a feeling to trying to find an answer. He doesn't just stop with being tired, because we could all agree that there is something happening or not happening in the world around us or in the world in general that is making us feel tired. He doesn't just stop there. He looks towards what's causing the issue. Let's cut the world in two and discover the worms that are eating away at the rind. And all of us in this room would probably have different answers for what types of worms are eating away at the rind, wouldn't we? Some of us would probably lean more towards a spiritual answer. This is what's eating away at the rind of the world. Some of us would have more of a geopolitical answer. This is what's eating away at the rind of the world. Some of us would have kind of a humanistic answer. The world would be great if humans weren't involved. And maybe for others of you, you have a mixture of all three mixed together, or you have something of your own, of what is eating away at the rind of the world. See, I think for Paul, when he's writing this first letter to the communities and the churches in Corinth, I think they're tired. Because it wasn't too much earlier that Christ was physically present in the world, right? It wasn't too much earlier that Christ was actually there, and the letters and the sermons and the miracles, they were just like 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. So it was close. They could almost still taste it and hear it and smell it. And they kept waiting. They kept waiting. And they kept waiting, and they kept waiting. And while they were waiting, they were watching. They were watching kind of this world fall apart in their understanding of the way the world should be. And especially in that city. I mean, people were worshiping other gods in every corner. And in addition to that, with people worshiping other deities, Paul has made it abundantly clear that there was no shortage of issues inside the community itself, right? So you had all of these things internally. You had all of these things externally. And Christ was just there, and he's talked about what was to come. And I have this idea that they're probably just tired. Now, Paul has addressed some of the worms that were eating away at the rind, right? This is what he's done so far in the letter. He talked about that they're, you know, all gifts are from God and they're all equal. And he's talked about letting Christ be your guide and not the culture. And now, after talking about all these worms as a source of division, he wants to talk about a way forward. How do we move forward in a world where we are waiting for it to become more beautiful, more loving, and more kind? What's the way we're supposed to do that? And in 1 Corinthians 13, at the very end of chapter 12, and he says, "And I will show you still a more excellent way." And Paul has a way to move forward while we are waiting for things to change. And that way is love. Now, we need to spend some time talking about this word love, because we all have a different understanding and definition of that word and what it means. All of us grew up with a foundational understanding of what it meant to love someone or something. My very first understanding of love, obviously, like most of us, was shaped by my childhood. Okay? So for me, love was chaotic. Love was unpredictable. Love was selfish. Love was violent. This was my understanding of love growing up as a child. And if you look to the realm where the church is actually located, they had a different understanding of love. Yeah, the temple of Aphrodite, so love was expressed by giving your body to other people. It was very sexually explicit. There was different things going at the temple. That was an example of love. And even if you look at the cultural examples today, love is romanticized, isn't it? What's the song, All You Need Is Love? Love is a feeling, is it not? And if it doesn't look like a Hallmark movie, I don't want it. Okay? If you don't come back to a small town from a distant thing and there's not a love story involved, it's probably not love. Okay? But is that what Paul means by love? Is this the type of love that Paul is talking about when he says, I want you to talk about a way forward? Is he talking about romantic love? Is he talking kind of like a kinship love, like a Philo, like a Philadelphia type of love, right? Like a brotherly type of love? What is Paul talking about? The word that Paul is using is agape, okay? And the definition has been behind me for just a minute, but I want to read it just because it's great, okay? This is a person that has spent their entire lives studying the Greek text and Paul and all this other type of stuff, and I just copied what he did because it was amazing, okay? For Paul, agape denotes, above all, a stance or attitude which shows itself in acts of will as regard, respect, and concern for who? The welfare of others. It is therefore profoundly Christological, for the cross is the model to follow, which is the way, and stance, which places the welfare of others above the interests of the self. So when Paul is talking about a way forward, and the way forward being love, while we are waiting for the world, while we believe that Christ is actively working through his power, through his spirit, through his church, through his word, and through his people, Paul has said, listen, I do not want you to be a source of division, because a house divided among itself cannot stand, right? I want you to get rid of all of this division. And as you move forward, as you expand this kingdom, the way I want you to do this is through love. And that love is not brotherly love. It's not kinship type of love. It is not a romantic or an erotic type of love that I want you to do that, because you've seen that all around you. I want you to model it after the love that Christ showed, which is agape love. If you want a great book on this, by the way, C.S. Lewis wrote a book called The Four Loves. It goes through Storge, Philo, Eros, and agape. Okay, what he would say in those books are all the types of love, the philo, which is brotherly love, the storge, which is kind of like this comfort type, like, you guys ever been to a place where you just feel like relaxed? Okay, storge is kind of that. Okay, you have your eros, which is your romantic love, which is I'm thankful for, because we share that, right, with your spouse, right? Okay, and you have your agape love. He says all loves are great gifts, but they make terrible gods, okay? So, The Four Loves, C.S. Lewis, great book. Read it slowly, as you have to do with C.S. Lewis, okay? So what Paul says is there's a way to get rid of the worms. And there's a way to get rid of the worms that are keeping the world from being good and beautiful, kind, and that way is love. And that love is modeled after who? The person of Christ. He does not use the culture as the example that everybody should follow. He does not use other apostles. He does not use current versions of different things. He said everything should be molded and shaped by Christ and the cross. It is a cruciform life that we are called to have as a church. Now, knowing that, now I want to read 1 Corinthians 13, okay? Because Paul again, is going to talk about the most excellent way forward, okay? Chapter 12, verse 31, the second part says, "And I will show you the most excellent way." Chapter 13, verse 1, "If I speak in tongues of men and of angels, but I have not love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal." Why do you think Paul starts off talking about gifts of speaking? You guys remember what we've talked about in that culture? What was where they placed the most high value? Last week we talked about the people that would give, that would be speaking in ecstatic utterances, or the people that were great at rhetoric, or the people that were philosophers. Those were the people that were seen as the upper echelon and as touched by God. So what Paul is addressing right away, he's saying, hey, listen, I know you put the most value on this. So listen, even if there is a person that speaks in the tongue of men and of angels, but they do not have love, they do not do it, if you want to go back one, okay, for the welfare of other people and modeling Christ, they are nothing but a noisy gong and a clanging cymbal. Okay? And let's just stay here on this slide. Paul continues, "And if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries, and I have all knowledge, and if I have all faith that I can remove mountains, but I do not have love, if I do not model myself for the welfare of others, if I do not take a stance which places their interests above myself, I'm nothing." If I give all that I have, and if I deliver up my body to be burned, but I do not have love, I gain nothing. There's people both back then and today that take the John Wayne approach, that they're going to, you know, kick down the door, you know, use their six shooters, pew, 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 and expand the gospel at all costs. They're a little bit rough around the edges, but hey, they're doing Christ's work, so it's okay. And Paul's saying, like, hey, listen, I don't think it is. Because you're not really gaining anything. So what does love look like? If you've been to a wedding in the past 40 years, you've heard this before. Love is patient. Love is kind. Love does not envy or boast. It is not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. Why? Because it looks for what? It looks for the welfare of others. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice in wrongdoing, but it rejoices with the truth. It bears all things, it believes all things, it hopes all things, and it endures all things. The only way that I am capable of modeling or mirroring a love to that degree is if that love comes from Christ and not myself. Because I have a shelf life on the type of love that I have. Let me give you an example. Maybe this isn't an example, okay? I don't know what this is, but I just thought about this, okay? Believe it or not, I can get irritable. I know this is very shocking because none of you have ever experienced this in your own lives, okay? Believe it or not, there have been times in my life where I have been resentful. Believe it or not, despite my best intentions and efforts, I am not capable of bearing all things. No matter how much I want to, I am not capable of enduring all things. I have had cluster headaches on and off for 5 weeks, okay? Mentally, physically, spiritually, it is one of the most draining things I've ever experienced, okay? It makes me more irritable. It makes me resentful. It makes me apathetic. I am not capable of bearing that by myself. Not only do I need a community of other people, but I need a Lord and a Savior who is greater and more powerful than I can even fathom or imagine. Okay? And we need a love that is not based just purely on feelings. We need a love that is not based purely on the strength of relationships like Philo. It's not just based on our conditions like storge. We need that because you and I, believe it or not, will experience things and navigate things that feelings are going to ebb and flow. So I need something more powerful than feelings. I'm going to navigate things where the conditions are not always going to be exactly what I want them to be, which is probably almost everything in adult life, right? So I need something bigger and better and outside of that that can help me navigate and bear all of those things. Paul goes on to say in verse 8, love never ends. And he does this great thing because he says, for as for prophecies, they're going to pass away. As for tongues, they're going to cease. As for knowledge, it is going to pass away. For we prophesy in part, but when the perfect comes, the partial will pass away. What Paul is saying is, listen, you have such a finite time period here on earth, okay? If the average lifespan for an adult male is somewhere around, 72 to 75 years old-ish? Anybody know? Because I'm just guessing. No. Let's just go with it, okay? Let's say it's 75, okay? I'm 45 years old. So that means I've got 30-ish years, give or take, right? The things that I am knowledgeable about or passionate about or am thinking about, the things that I'm trying to structurally change for the kingdom of God, what will those look like in 30 years? They're probably not going to be the same, right? Okay? When I was a mechanic, I was telling somebody this story the other day. You guys remember when you actually had physical keys? Some of you still do. Okay? And you put it in the lock cylinder and you would turn it, right? Okay, did anybody ever replace a lock cylinder on a car? Okay. So when I was a mechanic, I would replace lock cylinders. But not only would I replace them, I was one of the few techs in the shop that could actually build those with the different tumblers, okay? Tell me what that skill set is going to get me today. Absolutely nothing, okay? Maybe some nuanced thing is going to happen one day, but right, I had that knowledge back then, but it's past. Everything has moved forward, right? And what he's challenging people is to say, listen, the one thing that needs to be constant with you, because the things you're prophesying about in terms of the political leaders, in terms of the nations, in terms of what's going on, all of that is going to change. But the one thing that should never change is love, because that is modeling Christ in the cross. That needs to be the constant that you have as a community. The myriad of issues that the church has planted its flag on have changed across the centuries, have they not? There were churches during the Civil Rights Movement that were against segregation. Okay? Culture has moved past that, mostly, right? There's still pockets where that exists, unfortunately, right? Okay? In the late 80s, early 90s, what was the crisis where the church wanted to plant its flag, largely based in California, largely with the GLBT community? It was the AIDS crisis, right? Church planted its flag there, said, hey, you know, here's all these things. The world's going to end. It's going to do this. We got to take a stand. Things have moved on, right? Okay? The constant needs to be love. There are no shortage of hills that we can plant our flag on as a community, right? But if we don't do it with love, if it's not for the welfare of the others, if it's not modeling and mirroring the love of Christ in the shape of the cross, we are in danger of becoming irrelevant. For we know in part, because believe it or not, we don't know everything. I don't know everything. And we prophesy in part, but when the perfect comes, when Christ finally comes, all this is going to go away. When I was a child, I spoke like a child, and I thought like a child, and I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I gave up my childish ways. For now we see in a mirror dimly, which is another great C.S. Lewis book. But then when we are face to face, now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I have been fully known. What does he say in verse 13? So now, faith, hope, and love abide these three. But the greatest of these is what? Love. He's giving them marching orders. There's going to be issues that the church in Corinth was tired of. And he said the way forward is love. I want you to move forward in this way. And as you do, the worms that are eating away at the rind of the world, those will slowly go away. And for the next generation, he says, hey, listen, here are the worms that you believe are eating away at the rind of the world, and you're prophesying about them, and you're speaking about them, and that is great, and you can plant your flag on them, and that is also great. But I want you to understand that the way that you move forward with that is with love. You need to put the welfare of others in front of you. You need to model and mirror Christ. You need to take that posture. You need to be patient, kind. You need to not envy or boast. You don't need to be arrogant or rude. You don't need to insist on your own way. You shouldn't be irritable or resentful. You should not rejoice at wrongdoing. What you should really rejoice at is the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, and endures all things. There's three foundational ingredients, but the most greatest of the ingredients is love. So how do we do this, right? Can I just say something that I think may be a stance that we've heard before? If we're heavy on love, that means we're soft on sin. You guys heard something like that before, right? Maybe. That if I lead with love, then somehow I'm conceding somewhere and I'm not taking it seriously. So I just want to talk about three things and the myriad of other things that I've talked about. Yes. So how do we model agape? I just want to give you three pointers. You can show compassion without conceding your convictions. It's entirely possible for both things to be true at exactly the same time. Okay. Through breaking bread, we resurrected, in a manner of speaking, breaking bread in our community, okay? Through the Next Network and through partnership with St. Francis Hospital, a lot of other volunteers, okay? You know that we have served since April, that we have served right around 3,100 meals in our community in Litchfield. It's amazing, right? You know what we don't ask? I don't ask any questions when they ask me how many meals they want. It doesn't matter. If you're hungry, I'm going to give you food, right? Worst case scenario, they have food for two or three more days, which is not a problem. Do you think I agree with the life choices that every single person that comes through that line makes? Probably not, okay? But I still show compassion. And if anybody wants a definition of compassion, I said this before, compassion is empathy plus action, okay? You gotta have both. Because action that's uninformed can get just, it can go off course. Empathy without action is, doesn't really do anything, okay? Did Jesus ever practice compassion? Yes. Did he ever change his convictions? No. Were there examples where Jesus practiced compassion on somebody that didn't share his convictions?
Yes.
Okay. The woman caught in adultery did not share his convictions about relationships, right? Did Jesus withhold compassion until they matched in convictions? No. Did Zacchaeus hold the same convictions as his nation folk did about what it meant to be loyal? Did he share the same convictions of Jesus? Probably not. Did Jesus withhold compassion? No, he did not. Okay? The biggest problem we're facing, the biggest issue where people are pushing back, is because they are seeing the church withhold compassion because a group of people doesn't share a conviction. For me, that doesn't model Christ. Okay. Second thing is this. You can show love. And still have healthy boundaries. And this is kind of the opposite of what we talked about. And it's informed what Paul talked about. He says, if I give myself away and I give myself to be burned and I don't have love, then I am nothing. And what I've seen in ministry and what I've seen in Christianity is there's this implicit idea that I am just supposed to run myself ragged for the sake of Jesus and the gospel. If somebody treats me poorly, then I just turn the other cheek. If somebody convicts me of sin, who am I to judge? What am I supposed to do? I'm supposed to do the Christian thing, which is to forgive and forget. Do you know that sometimes the most loving thing you can do for a person is to let them suffer the consequences of their own actions? Do you know that sometimes modeling healthy love is saying, here is a healthy boundary? Is to say, listen, this version of you is not going to be compatible with this version of this. Do you know that that creates this beautiful place where you still honor the other person, but you still protect what God has given you? I think of the story of the rich young ruler, where Jesus said, hey, listen, Here is the barrier that's keeping you from being able to come into this place. I need you to make a change there before this can happen. And the rich one, young ruler, it says he went away sad because he was unwilling to make the change. So the first one says, I should be generous with love. And the second one says, but I should never be so generous with love that I put myself or my family at risk. Does that make sense? Let me give you an example. When we first joined forces with, I'll give you a better example than that one, okay? It's often that we used to get a lot of phone calls from the Litchfield Police Department. And sometimes, since we have transportation services, what they would say is, hey, so-and-so just got trespassed from this property and they need a ride somewhere. I'm wondering if you can come get them, okay? So about a year and a half ago, if I got a phone call, I would say yes. Why? I want to be a community partner, and I want to add value to that relationship, right? I want to make a deposit in that account, that relational account. So here's what happens one Saturday. I get a phone call from a police officer. John, this is Officer so-and-so. Somebody just got trespassed from the Motel 6. We're wondering if he could do transportation. I'm at home. Am I working? Absolutely not. I'm at home with my family. I don't work on Saturdays. I don't work on Fridays. I pick up my phone to start sending the group text to all of my staff and volunteers. The group text was going to be, hey, we need to give a ride to somebody who wants to do it. So here's the message. I'm going to protect my space and my day off, but I'm not going to protect yours. What type of message does that send to your employees? That you're just on call all the time. I'm not going to leave my house, but you may have to leave yours. That sends a very confusing message, right? I use that to talk about the idea of healthy boundaries. That if I'm willing to protect my time and my family, then I should have a healthy boundary to protect their time and their family, right? That's a healthy boundary. This is what we need to do when it comes to talking about the welfare of others. Just because we should be modeling Christ and moving forward with the welfare of others, it does not mean that we put our families or ourselves at risk. Does that make sense? Yes, no? Thumbs up? Okay, good job. Third one is this, and this is probably the most controversial one. You can show love and disagree with someone. Do you guys know most of the things we're disagreeing on aren't going to be issues? Or that specific thing probably won't be an issue in 10 or 15 years. You guys remember the old beer commercials? Tastes great, less filling. Okay. Slobbing back and forth. Do you think it's possible to work towards the welfare of another person that you disagree with? I think it's entirely possible. Not only do I think it's possible, but I think it's probably one of the most needed things that the church could promote in this day and age. I mean, culturally speaking, unfortunately, we are working in an age of polarities, are we not? Tell me the middle ground. Tell me the middle ground where there is a moderate candidate. Tell me the middle ground where one political party does not just totally go against the other one. I think there is enough room for the church to model a way that says, I can still want the welfare of the other person, even though I disagree with them on this point. I can still be compassionate. I can still be patient. I can still be kind. I can still do all of these other things. In a world where everything is so full of polarities and venom and everybody just dividing on every single issue, wouldn't it be great if there was a group of people that says, hey, there is a third option. And that option is to show the love of Christ to people that we disagree with. I believe that people often fear that if they lead with compassion or if they lead with that, sometimes they're going to be seen as they will view themselves as soft on sin or disingenuous. But when Paul is talking about agape, he's not talking about this permissive thing. He's not talking about this ambiguous love that is just saying, no, we just love everybody and it's all great and you can do whatever you want and it's entirely fine. Paul is not advocating for that. The type of love that Paul is talking about, it's not permissive, it's cruciform. It absorbs all the costs. It hopes, it perseveres. The type of love that Paul is talking about, it bears all things and it endures all things. And the reason why it's so beautiful is because it removes it as from a function of John Magnuson and puts it on a function of the cross. Because the cross has enough strength, and what Christ did has enough strength to bear showing compassion on somebody without losing its convictions. John does not always have that strength. The cross has the strength and the endurance to show love and wanting the welfare of another person, even though I disagree with them. John does not always have that strength. And when we model and we shape our love and the way that we are trying to get rid of the worms of the world, and we model that after Christ, then maybe we won't be so tired. Because I'm not the one who's trying to bear all things. I don't have to endure it because I can say, you know what, I know what my job is and I know what Christ did on the cross. And I may disagree with this person. It reminds me of a story. Before we had our office building, I used to meet with clients here in the church. And there was one client in particular. How do I say this in mixed company? There are certain things that people do that automatically make me want to push them away. And we all have our own different things, right? We all have different triggers is the easiest way to say that, right? For example, for me, two words that will just never fly in my house. The word shut up will never fly in my house, and the word stupid will never fly in my house, okay? Those words for me, if you say them, I'm not going to give you a 2 or 3 reaction, I'm going to give you a 10 reaction, okay? So there's certain clients, because of their background, their history, and what they've done and what they've left undone, automatically, I don't go from a 1 or 2 or 3, I'm automatically a 10. Okay, and most of the time I want to recuse myself because I'm like, I know I can't give you the best care because of what you did, the way it makes me feel inside. Does that make sense? Okay. So there's one client that comes in. And I'm really, really, really struggling because there's no ownership, there's no accountability, there's nothing, you know, perpetual, it's... was never my fault, and I don't do well with that anyway, right? If you make your bed, you sleep in it, you should take ownership. This is what a healthy program looks like. This is what healthy, this is just what healthy adulthood looks like. And I remember calling my mentor, And I said, man, I'm just really, really struggling. I'm struggling because of X, and I'm struggling because of the attitude. And he said, John, you need to decide something right now. He says, you need to decide whether what you offer is a right or a privilege. See, in that moment, my mentor was my tormentor, right? Because he says, John, if it's a privilege, you can say yes or no to whoever you want to based on whatever reason you want to. He says, but if the services you offer are going to be a right, you don't have the ability to say no. It's an inherent right that they have to get quality care. It was just me at the time, so it was just me. But now he would say to me, if it's not you, who's the best person on your team that can do it? What we offer at the Next Network is a right. You have the right to get the help that you need, regardless of what you've left done or undone in this world. And that is informed by my faith in the way that Christ loved other people. When Paul is talking about the way forward, agape, he is not talking about a privilege. He is not saying to the church, hey, listen, if they agree with you politically, if they look like you, if they practice everything the way that they do, if they've never done this, if they've always done that, then you lead with agape. What he's saying is, I need you to understand, because of the way what Christ did on the cross, leading with agape is a right for every single person that interacts with somebody who calls himself a Christian. They are entitled to that because that's exactly what you receive from Christ. Agape is the way to get rid of the worms of the world. And we have to understand that it is a right and not a privilege that we can disseminate whenever we feel like it, to whomever we feel like it. Because it's modeled after who? Christ. It's modeled after the cross. 1 John tells us we know what love is because what? Because Christ first loved us. Let us go and do the same. As we try to make our way forward, even though we're tired of waiting for this world to become good and beautiful and kind. Will you pray with me, please? Father, thank you for your Son, Jesus. Thank you, Father, for the way he not only lived in this world, but the way that he modeled for us to follow. Father, I would pray that you would just help us. Help us to model and mirror a cruciform life, not only within our own families, but outside to the other people that we interact with, Father. May that be the way that we move forward in our relationships. May that be the way that we move forward in the way that we view ourselves. May that be the way that we move forward when we interact with other people. And Father, if there is anything that we are holding on to, if there's any cultural idea that we think is what your love should look like, that isn't what it should, Father, I pray that you would just convict us and just remove that from our eyes and our understanding. If there's anything inside of us, Father, that's keeping us from being or becoming or moving in the way that you desire us to as individuals or as a church, Father, I pray that through your Spirit and through your Word, that you would remove those, whether those are footholds or strongholds or lies, Father. I pray that you would not only replace those, but that you would break those down. So that, Father, your way, the way of agape, may just advance your kingdom here on earth. We ask this together in the name of your Son, Jesus. Amen. I want you to take the next few moments and just take time to interact with Christ. After that, we'll have communion, and then we will worship through song.